Welcome one and all to the world's only podcast, the only podcast in the world, brought to you each month from the AOS 21 Podcast Network, hosted on Podomatic. And now for our commentators, Ian Roberts and Joshua Silberman.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the final episode ever of the world's only podcast, the only podcast in the world. Wow, our final episode. Can you believe that?
I think we'd be proud that we never did a bad episode.
Never did a bad episode ever.
But we have an hour to change that. So who knows? Maybe this is it. I was promoting the show. I was putting the show out on Twitter and Facebook, and I said, I refer to it as the penultimate episode, which is it's a weird word because every time I read it or hear it, I think that means the last, but it doesn't. It sounds like it should be the last, right? Penultimate.
I remember as a kid understanding the difference between quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals.
It's a good way to learn fractions. Honestly, that's how I learned.
How are you feeling, Ian?
I'm doing okay. It's, you know, we'll be recapping the year here, and it's going back over my notes and preparing for this. I was kind of like, man, we covered a rough couple of years.
When did we start? 2015 or 2016?
16. It was like spring or summer of 2016.
Oh, yeah, when all seemed still possible.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a different time.
Oh, God. All right. Well, we will get into that eventually. But for now, we have to get into our final wrap-ups. You ready?
Let's go. The biggest story of the year, the last 2 years, really, is the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Now, earlier this year, as the summer began, there was a sense of optimism. The vaccine was widely available, at least, you know, for adults in the U.S., and warm weather meant that we could gather outside and be safe, and it felt great. And then vaccination rates plateaued somewhere around July. Shortly thereafter, the Delta variant emerged. Now, Delta is still the primary variant here in the U.S., but the new Omicron variant is here, and it is spreading fast. The strain seems to be no more deadly or severe in terms of its symptoms, but it's a lot more viral, causing it to spread faster and be more of a threat to the most vulnerable parts of the population. Now, positive COVID cases have spiked and will continue to spike until at least after people stop traveling for the holidays, because Americans have long since stopped pretending that we're taking any precautions here. Now, 5.5 million people worldwide have died of COVID-19. Over 800,000 Americans have died of COVID. Now, I want to provide some context. About 1.3 million Americans have died in war. So in less than 2 years, we're over 60% of the way to matching the American death rate in every war we've ever fought. We said on the show some months back that in the U.S., at least, we were vaccine or bust. Well, Americans proved us wrong because the country chose vaccines and bust. We have all the vaccine availability that you could possibly want, but we stalled at around 60% fully vaccinated, with around 73% fully or partially vaccinated. Herd immunity rates are estimated to require between 70 and 90%, so we could be almost there or quite a ways off. It's not promising. Sylvie, when we were establishing topics for this episode, our initial prompt was, is this getting better or worse? But in the weeks since you and I talked, I'd say the clear answer has emerged. This is getting worse. Do you have a counterpoint?
The only counterpoint I have is, and this may seem a little weird, is that things are still open and it does seem like some places are adapting. I can't argue. Things are getting worse. The hospitalization numbers and death numbers speak for themselves. Well, maybe not the hospitalization numbers exactly. It is worth pointing out, and I think this is important to stress, that it does seem that vaccinations, especially booster shots, prevent hospitalization. They may not prevent you from getting sick entirely, but they may protect your family and everyone around you. So already I'm going to throw that in, you know, get boosted. I've been boosted. My wife's been boosted. I can't speak for what you're doing, but I have put in a strict, you're either vaccinated or you don't see my kid policy.
Yeah, we've essentially had that as well. You know, we've had some travel over the past couple of months. We didn't, but some people we know, including my mother, and she was around some people that we know weren't vaccinated. And so we said, you at least have to get a test, because she's boosted and everything. She's been responsible, but we were taking all those kind of precautions. And that was pre-Omicron. So, yeah, we're taking some more precautions. We kept thinking about, my wife and I, our Christmas gifts to each other are going to be, we should plan a date. And we were actually thinking about, oh, let's go see a movie because she really wants to see House of Gucci. And I was kind of like, you know what, maybe we could do it. And then over the course of a couple of days, and I'll get into this more about what's going on at work for me, is I suddenly felt really weird doing that. Like, we were also going to go out to lunch yesterday. We took the day off and just, no, we don't feel right doing it. It happens so, so fast. If I may talk a little about, I think I can talk about this here. At work, we have been on site for about 2, maybe 3 days a week, and they have been considering, okay, everyone be here 4 days a week. And then within a couple of days, everyone is now virtual again, and we'll be through at least the first week of January.
So I'll counter that with at work, things are still pretty normal for me. Now, I am in a much, much, much smaller office. There's only about 12 of us. And I would say even six of us work remote at any given time. I have been working fully remote since my son was born. I am trying to get back to 2 days in the office. I know everyone in my office is vaccinated. It is a mandate that you vaccinate. So I feel a little better about it, but I also don't take public transportation. I have a private office, so on and so forth. So I can't necessarily speak to how that might feel. And yeah, as you were talking about like the try to set up a date night with your wife, I was thinking to myself, we're still at the 1 month mark. Like my son is about 6, 7 weeks old, and we're nowhere near getting back to that routine yet. So I haven't it hasn't even crossed my mind that people are trying to do it. And I kind of wonder, how would we feel about going out? We went out during Delta, so I imagine that we would probably go out during Omicron, but again, that's just us. So
If not for the kid. Yeah, that's, I think we might, I think we're kind of in the same, if not for the kid, I think we would, because she and I are both vaxxed and boosted, we're fine. And she probably would be okay. Small children seem to do okay with it. There was a respiratory thing, not COVID, going around her daycare, though, because we keep remembering she goes to school with a bunch of other people who, we would end up, we're effectively in a bubble with all those other people, too.
Which, and I feel the need to point out, and this is even though I just had a kid, even I understood one of the points of that type of setup is that they do get sick, is that they build their immune systems now, isn't it?
It is, but do you want to chance it with this? That's the difference with a lot of other things. Yeah, I mean that's part of the appeal of sending your kid to daycare is okay, they build up immune system and build up things. With this is a little bit different because she's also there with some of the teachers there are a little bit on the older end as well. They're all vaccinated and stuff, but we have to think about those people as well. If we're anything else, if this were a normal time, it's like yeah, you go there, they get sick, they get pink eye, they get whatever, and you build up immunities to that sort of thing. This is not a normal thing. As normal as we've made it feel over the last year and a half, 2 years, I'm not gambling with it.
And that's kind of where I kind of want to go with this, is what exactly the new normal looks like. I have to say that, as the more we go on, and the easier it gets to prove these things. Like for example, New Jersey just came out with a COVID passport. No one's checking it, but we have it. The more I'm inclined to say, okay, I'm more comfortable with vaccine mandates. I'm more comfortable with what's it called, exposure notifications on your phone. What I really wonder is, what does it look like for things like travel? Because one of the things we do want to do with this kid is when he gets around a year old, is we want to take him to Israel to meet his Israeli family, which is important to me and my wife. Now, we remember the stories I told of us going with Delta. I don't want to do that with a kid. Is it ever going to get to a point where we can just hop on a plane again, or are those days over?
I think they can. At some point, I don't know. He's talking about a year from now. I got to assume that at that age, you could get them a vaccine for this. At that point, would you feel more comfortable? Because our worry with our child is she's three. She's not. Five is the lowest cutoff, I believe.
So in terms of vaccination, what I've been reading recently is that Pfizer recently had a trial of their vaccine for 2 to 5 year olds that wasn't particularly successful. Now, on one hand, you can read that as a setback, and I definitely understand that for anybody who has a toddler. But the way I read it, having an infant, is that okay, this means that by the time he hits two, a vaccine for 2 year olds will hopefully have been out for a while.
I mean, the rate this has been going, I would imagine you said travel with him when he's about a year, so that's another, what, 11 months now. That's got to be enough time, right? Because this thing is, we've developed this thing pretty fast.
I definitely think it'll be for toddlers. I think about how long it took to get a vaccine for 5 year olds. For some reason, it just seemed a lot slower than adults. I get it. They wanted to take their time with children, but even with some of the setbacks we had, I just felt it was so much slower. And I heard so many stories of parents who got so frustrated waiting that they actually tried to sign their own children up for trials and actually tried to convince pharmacists to give them half the dose of an adult anyway before it was even prescribed. So I'm not counting on it. The way I generally function with my son is, as I said, vaccine or bust. In terms of if you can't get vaccinated, like if you have your own infant, I'm not going to keep my infant away from your infant. I feel like that's just unreasonable measures. It's not really helping anybody. If you can get vaccinated and you choose not to, that's the type of person I'm going to keep him away from.
If places were checking pass, vaccine passports, and that's the one place where I feel like, would you check it there? We're like, I know businesses aren't going to do it, but maybe airports would. If you're doing that, then you can register. Okay, even if your son doesn't have it yet, because he's too young or whatever, then at least the other passengers on the plane are covered, and maybe you're okay then. But there's a lot. There are a lot of variables in travel, as you know. You just run into people who just haven't done it. It's a matter of people actually enforcing these things. That comes back to, we talked about some vaccine mandates. I think we're mostly talking about businesses and schools doing it, right? Governments aren't going to do it because, like with lockdowns, no government wants to deal with that headache because it's too much of a problem. You know, it's so weird. We're at a really weird point in this thing, and I don't know if it's seasonal affectiveness disorder or what's going on, but it feels about as bad as it did in March of 2020 because. For months, people have been demanding we return to normal. And guess what? The people in charge said, okay, we'll return to normal. No more child tax credit, no more stimulus, no more debt deferral. We're back to normal, but the pandemic is still going while they demand that we live our normal lives. And it's a really bleak situation.
Well, in that regard, I mean, this is what vaccines are supposed to be for. They're supposed to help us live more normal lives. It's back in 2020, we had nothing for this. Although I will mention a pretty grim statistic I read, which boggled my mind given the number of tools we have right now to fight COVID, which is more Americans died of COVID in 2021 than in 2020. And I guess that points to the fact that people aren't, even though they have vaccines, they aren't taking nearly as many precautions as they did before.
Your son does not like the arguments you're making.
No, he does not.
I saw an Australian commenting on their country's progress getting vaccinated. I found a source here that I will share. In late June, Australia was at about 5% vaccinated. At that same time, the US was at 48%. Now, flash forward to December, Australia is at 75% fully vaccinated. The US is stuck at 60. And the crux of what the Australian commenter was saying was, how did we surpass you so dramatically when you all have such access to the vaccine? Because I think we're now up to, 73%, at least partially vaccinated. I don't know how that accounts for boosters or anything else. But because this thing was politicized so early on, you know, that was true everywhere, but it caught, you know, you said we have the tools to do it. Yeah, but we're not taking advantage of those tools.
You say we, the kind of collective we. There's definitely America. Two different Americas here on this. There is, let's face it, there's blue America. Around me, everybody's pretty much vaccinated, and life is pretty much back to normal. People are going out to bars. People are going out to restaurants.
Are masks still on?
No. Well, they aren't mandated, but they are still on in many places. I would say many businesses, supermarkets especially, are mandating it. I know I've been scolded at least once for going into a local Wawa without a mask.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's definitely there. We generally wear masks as a protection for the kid. But, you know, most of the people who are dying in more Republican America. And yeah. I feel like there's some sense of schadenfreude there, but this affects all of us. So.
You talk about the Herman Cain Award. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Nah. Oh, wait. I feel like I know where this is going.
Yes. Anyone doesn't know. I think there's a subreddit for it. There might be a wider internet thing, too, where you post a social media post of someone who it was a anti-vaxxer, thought COVID was a hoax. You do a bunch of those posts, and then you do the post about, oh, I contracted COVID. Oh, it's really bad. I'm on oxygen now. And then there's a final post of a family member saying, you know, so-and-so passed away, which I don't like because it feels like dancing on someone's grave. But it's also like you're going to make all these big claims and then you're going to contract this thing and die. And I do feel bad for those people, but I don't think you can expect everyone is going to feel bad for you necessarily. I don't think that we're dumber than any other country. I've traveled enough to know that there are stupid people everywhere, but we are loudly stupid in a way that I don't see much across the rest of the world. And that loudness permeates. It makes us seem a lot dumber than we are. And I think a lot of people have been coddled to a degree that they think they can just ignore this as a problem. What we have with COVID is a problem that requires collective action, and that's not something the U.S. has been good at for a little while now.
I mean, we haven't been good at it for a long, long, long time.
I think you see that problem in other countries as well. The U.K. is clearly having that problem where they're not good at the collective action anymore, and that's what this requires. There's no decision you can make as an individual that will make COVID go away.
Yeah, if we did the things that were actually necessary. I mean, even I have friends that refused to stop traveling during COVID when the CDC said not to. And those are friends who are very much aware, pro-vaccine, understand what COVID is, still not willing to make that decision. So I definitely don't see this as something we're gonna tackle or really, really fix anytime soon. We probably got to get to our final thoughts here. So I'll start. You know, as you said, Americans have had it, although I am starting to see around me more actual mandates pop up. New York is requiring at least, I guess you could call it partial vaccination for restaurants, bars, things, movie theaters, things like that. I'm hoping New Jersey is going to institute something like that, though it seems highly unlikely given the thrashing that our governor took in the election. Like, he almost lost office to a no-name Republican. So he's got to skirt the issue pretty carefully.
You read The Great Gatsby, right?
Of course.
Yeah. I never thought about it before, but Nick Carraway, the narrator, never mentions the Spanish flu. Like, it's something all of those characters would have lived through just a little bit before the book happens, and it never comes up, because, like, Jay Gatsby and Daisy don't want to think about it anymore, and neither did the readers of the time. And I think about, like, COVID was the biggest story in the duration of the World's Only Podcast. I think fair to say the biggest of our lifetime. It surpassed 9/11 a while ago. But we spent several episodes of this show where you and I barely mentioned it, and that's because often there was nothing to talk about with regard to COVID. It became background noise that we kind of preferred to ignore. Everyone was thinking about it, and it's pushed the limits of human attention to the breaking point, and it's going to keep going. I think that's why pandemic fatigue is the phrase we used a lot, right? Everyone has been there for months. We know it's bad. We know it's getting worse. We see the numbers spiking. I think you talked about death rates early in the segment. Come back to look at those death rates right around New Year's, because it's going to look real, real bad, I think. It's weird to live through something so huge that doesn't stop.
All right, ready to move on to the next segment?
Let's go.
This episode is sponsored by...
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/AOS21. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/AOIS21. Okay, so the other stories worth following in 2020 were political. And really, in my mind, it comes down to one big thing, which is what is going to happen in the midterm election in 2022. And really, the way we look at that is we look at the state of the two major parties in the U.S. From the Republican side, you basically have a party that is, at least at the national level, has sunken more into authoritarianism. I can't speak too much about more rural areas, but I can tell you that in my state, the Republicans have surprisingly regrouped under a state that is mostly blue, considered mostly reliably Democratic. The Republicans have pretty much regrouped to give Governor Murphy a run for his money. I mean, we came 3 percentage points within having a Republican governor. We already ousted our state Senate president, which was really surprising. And that can actually be extrapolated nationally come November, when the Republicans also gained, I think it was, what, two major governorships, at least one in Virginia. I forget if there was another one.
Those are the two gubernatorial elections, but Virginia, you know, blue-ish state is now has a Republican governor.
So, which really nobody expected. And this is bad. I mean, it's not just bad for the Democrats. I think it's bad for democracy in general, because, as I said, the Republicans have taken on a more authoritarian lean. It's very possible that Trump is going to run again in 2024, which is why I understand when you and I were coming up with the show notes, but we definitely need to acknowledge what the Republicans are. But I feel like the debate on that is over. We know how bad they are.
Let's start with the Republicans. We'll come to the Democrats, because the Democrats do deserve criticism, quite a lot of criticism. But to say that it's all on them kind of lets the Republicans off the hook. And I do appreciate where that perspective comes from, that the Republicans are irredeemable. But the media does this framing of Republicans versus Democrats as like the Mad Magazine spy versus spy thing, just senselessly blowing each other up. I think that's disingenuous, because only one party orchestrated a coup attempt this past year. In this past month, the revelation of the PowerPoint coup, as it's been called, former White House chief of staff turned over a PowerPoint presentation to Congress outlining options for Mike Pence to overturn the election result. And when Mike Pence demurred, and by the way, we have Mike Pence of all people to thank for things not getting much uglier on January 6th. But when Pence declined, and I'm quoting here from the story, Trump then pressed his lieutenants about how to stop Biden's certification from taking place entirely. That was the insurrection, the storming of the Capitol. You know, we have to say, we will get to the Democrats here, but we have an not just anti-democratic, I think anti-republic or anti-representation.
Isn't the word authoritarian?
You said authoritarian, but that's one of our major parties just doesn't like our system now, because they can't reliably win. Yeah. I
mean, they could definitely win through backhanded and forehanded tactics, which I'll get into later. Not all of their tactics are under the table here. Many of them are just taking advantage of the lower levels of power, which is the way our system was designed.
I did read someone comment, do Republicans really need to rig any election when Democrats are going to be this unpopular? Like, the Democrats aren't really doing anything at any level of government, it seems. And they've made it very easy. I don't want to shift to them just yet, because I think we do need to really underline the fact that we have one party that is willing to just burn it all down.
And what scares me is, again, you know, we keep saying we'll get to the Democrats. But what scares me is when I look at the two parties, and let's face it, we are a two-party system. Parties might be made up of factions, but it is a two-party system. The Republicans are just so much more united. They're so much more organized. They're so much more efficient. They're everything the Democrats are not when it comes to actual organization execution.
Republicans have had a cohesive ecosystem for several decades now. They don't necessarily agree with each other, but they know how to defer to other people, how to, you know, follow the leader, get in line.
Their turn.
Yeah. They've been much better at this for a long time. And that's part of where my despair comes from is maybe the Democrats could put that together, but that's going to take time that we don't have.
I'm not even sure they can. I mean, the Democrats have, and this is, I guess, for the transition, have turned themselves into such a big tent party, which there's nothing necessarily wrong with. You want to say, you know, you want everybody to come in. But the problem is when you have that many voices trying to get to the top of the heap at once and no one's willing to say, okay, I'll wait my turn. We have a bigger objective to get. You get the cluster F that currently is the Democratic Party. And the problem that they have right now is that the loudest voices in the party are not only not numerous among Democrats, they're also practically writing the GOP's playbook. I mean, I'm talking about things like defund the police, which just today I read a story about the San Francisco mayor declaring a state of emergency in one of their neighborhoods because of crime. And that's a small version of what's happening across the country. You know, they have been pinged for trying to change around language, the failing of the so-called Latinx introduction. And then there's the concept of trying to put in the concept of biopic, BIPOC versus POC. Are you leaving certain people out by doing that? These are many of the debates that are dominating the Democratic Party. Yes, they have the Build Back Better initiative. They have the social spending safety net. But when you're not talking about those, you're talking about these. And yes, it's mostly the Republicans who are fanning the flames of it. But the flames are there to fan.
You did link me to, I thought this was really good, and a piece in New York Magazine by Jonathan Chait talking about what's breaking it down. And I fear that some people would read that and see, like, oh, you're just blaming both sides. But I think both sides need to be blamed. And I'm going to quote from him. The truth is that Biden's presidency began to disintegrate without abandoning the center at all. He found himself trapped between a well-funded left wing that has poisoned the party's image with many of its former supporters and centrists unable to conceive of their job in any terms save as valets for the business elite. So in short, the left fringe turns off the public while the center of the party is crippled with fear of doing anything. So you end up getting painted with the broad brush of being too far left while also not doing any of those so-called far left things that might help people in some way. We just saw this week that the Democrats are abandoning the or shelving, I should say, is the word they use, the Build Back Better program, in favor of going to voting rights reform. Now, I get it from an existential point of view, you need to do the voting rights thing. But for one thing, I'm not convinced that you have votes to do the voting rights either. For another thing, shelving means the bill is dead. I don't think they ever really had the votes for it. I held out hope that they could maybe get that done. But by not doing those things like extending the child tax credit, which was super popular, people just say, well, what are you doing? You're not giving people anything. And it leaves a power vacuum. You're not doing anything with the chance that you have. Even the best of circumstances, I think Democrats are probably going to lose both houses in 2022. But doing nothing just promises a bloodbath. Like, Biden hasn't even gotten to appoint a Supreme Court judge at this point. There hasn't been an opening, yes, but could he now if he wanted to? So it's a nasty situation. By the way, I'll stop ranting here in a minute. I'll let you go. My sympathies with this, by the way, are with the left of the party. I think they're generally right on these things. But apart from Bernie Sanders, who, by the way, not a Democrat, none of them has found a way to explain their policies in a way that resonates. So it leaves the party to the centrists in power who can't or won't do anything. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious. You say your sympathies are with the left in terms of what exactly? Because many of the initiatives that are in Build Back Better, I could argue, are their priorities. But for some reason, they're not what's making the news. You know, it's the people who flaunt the things that I mentioned earlier. Defund the police, which has fallen flat. Latinx, which has fallen flat. The concept of critical race theory and school choice, which somehow the Republicans managed to take and turn into an issue, a wedge issue in Virginia. So,
and now they've stopped talking about it after they've won. That's weird.
Yeah, and just wait until the 2022 midterms ramp up. Sorry, go ahead.
When I say they're right, I mean in terms of the Build Back Better stuff that we need, to a Green New Deal type stuff. Like, I think those are things that would be good for this country, that would be popular, that would work. They're not good at explaining those things a lot of the time. I agree, but those are also the things that the center of the party says, no, we don't need to do that, or, you know, just little things that could make things, but, you know, little popular things you could do that the mansions.
So you would say we don't necessarily need a moral change in language?
No, I don't think that does anything. I mean, actual policy.
All right. No, I mean, that I can definitely get behind. I mean, I have watched the Republicans just use defund the police to hammer the Democrats, and I don't really see the Democrats doing much to fight it. One of the things I'm going to link to here is a opinion piece in the New York Times, of all places, saying, you know, blue states, you're the problem. In my mind, and I know this is Republicans thinking this too, one of the biggest things I can point to as to why I'm not an added supporter of the Democrats, despite the Republicans being an authoritarian party, is that the Democrats control the largest cities in this country. They have the most resources, they have the most educated populace, but they still can't get anything done, even at that state and local level. And that's something. And if you do a comparison of poverty, the red states, Texas especially, generally come out on top.
In top, on top in which sense?
Let's see. They're better able to house people. They're better able to feed people. They don't have nearly as... The biggest one I know right now is the housing crisis, which isn't nearly as bad in Texas as in California.
Yeah, in a cold winter, I think I'd rather be in California than Texas right now.
That depends if you have a house or not.
Having a house and no heat is basically having no house. I can tell you because it happened to me once. But, I mean, we're getting up to... They're certainly better at getting some things done. You talk about... You seem to refer to the language that they're using. And Republicans have people who use that kind of language as well, but they have other people who clean that up. They're better at it. They have, you know, the think tanks and other academia-adjacent organizations that work within what I call that conservative ecosystem that do come up with ideas that would be very unpopular if they were actually pitched, but you have filters within that ecosystem that keep them from getting pitched to the public because they know we
can't.
Why
don't the Democrats have that? Why weren't they?
There's no organization.
Are you sure there's no organization? Because I feel like they're smart enough to put that organization together if they wanted to. The sense I get is that, again, the really activist, grassroots, far-left part of their party doesn't want to because they feel a moral imperative to push these things the way that they currently are.
Are we talking about, we seem to be stuck on a language, which is part of it, but I think there's also the part of the left is also the part that's pushing things like Green New Deal, Build Back Better in a way that they're... yes, the language, I think, is a problem. None of them except Bernie Sanders is good explaining them, but... In terms of actually getting things done legislatively, they're actually at least trying something, whereas I think it's the center that's holding up the things that would actually matter. I think you could use whatever stupid language you want, but as long as you're perceived to getting things done for people, you'll do okay. See Trump, for example. Relatively few people like the things coming out of his mouth, but if he does things that work for them, like give them a stimulus check with his name on it, people are going to vote for it.
Yep, definitely true. All right, I think we got to wrap up our final thoughts here. So do you want to go first?
Are you disappointed that we won't get to cover the second Trump administration?
I'm actually more disappointed that I'm not going to get to follow, that we're not going to get to cover what's going on right now, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the Cold War among the Democrats, which Jonathan Chit sort of talked about. As far as I'm concerned, it's here.
We've covered this a little bit. When we've talked about politics, at least the last 2-4 years, it's been about the state of the Democrats, which needs to be done. But I also feel it's disingenuous to leave out the fact that there's one party that is much, much worse in terms of what they want for the country. It's really hard right now. It's hard for me not to feel a little bit of despair. And I think we'll get to this more in our final segment as well. It's a really bad situation. I'll leave my final thoughts as a question to you. What hope do the Democrats have in the next like 2 or 4, next year or 3 years for the midterms of the presidential election? Because abortion might get the base out, maybe, but who do the Democrats have to put up against Trump? Like, I think Biden is actually now talking about running, which I didn't think he would, but who do they have? Who's their next person? I honestly don't know.
I don't know, and I think in my mind, the first thing the Democrats have to do is there's this TV show out there called, and it's based on a book, but I won't get into the book, called Foundation. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
I have.
Okay, so the concept behind Foundation is it takes place in a large galactic empire that's an analogy for the Roman Empire. And the idea is the Foundation, using a science that back then was called some type of a pseudo-psychic science in the 50s, but we can now refer to as big data, has basically predicted that once this galactic empire falls, humanity is in for, I think it was something like 10,000 years of a dark age, where we're just basically fighting each other. It's like the medieval time all over again. Mm-hmm. But this Foundation is hoping to preserve a microcosm of society that could reduce that dark age from 10,000 years to 1,000 years. What I'm getting at is, I don't see any situation where we get through the next 10, 15 years without some sort of pain. What I'm looking at is what we can do to either reduce the pain or, to use a term that nobody likes, build back better once that actually happens. And what I'm really getting at here is, how does that Democratic Cold War play out? best case scenario in my mind, this won't happen, but the best case scenario in my mind is that the Republicans win in 2022, as we expect them to. The progressives of the party just get so sick of the party that they split off from it and they finally form their own party. You know, maybe Bernie Sanders finally ramps up the DSA as its own political party or something else comes of it and we finally break the two-party system. Now, granted, that is going to leave us with another cycle of Republican rule, but I also think it's fully possible that you'll finally get disenchanted voters like me who aren't reliable Democratic voters. I definitely wasn't. I voted for Governor Murphy, the Democrat, for governor, but I voted Republican down the rest of the ballot because, oh my God, are the Democratic officials here corrupt? So in that vein, I could easily see the Democrats rebuilding themselves as a centrist party that isn't necessarily just controlled by a cabal of academics, if that makes sense.
I think you have more faith in corporate Democrats being popular than I do.
Well, I don't necessarily have faith in them being popular. I have faith in, much like the Republicans, of them getting stuff done, of them actually being able to organize, of them being able to get those voices in order the way that the Republicans can. I don't necessarily care about populism per se. I understand its importance, but what I understand is process and efficiency. That's what the Democrats don't have right now, and that's what they need to find if they're going to get anything passed.
And the centrists have been very efficient. All right. So, sorry, I stepped on your last comment if you want to go again.
No, it's okay. I mean, you're right. They haven't been efficient. This goes well beyond what the scope of what we're talking about. I would argue that they've hit a wall with what they can do because of the arguments many, not even the progressives in government, but many of the base have made regarding things like police, language, schools. But I can't argue that you are right. The centrists have really screwed up on their own. I mean, it's one senator. It is one senator at this point that is holding up Build Back Better. Even he needs to recognize that something needs to pass for their party, or even he could be replaced by a Republican in the next cycle.
All right, ready to move on?
No, and after that, I'm taking your line. No, I'm not. I need a cold shower, but let's go.
All right.
This episode is sponsored by...
So I'm looking for some Expos merch, but all I'm seeing are old Andre Dawson jerseys. Do you know where I can find some more recent stuff?
Well, I don't know who, what, or where the Expos are, but I can tell you that you can now pick up Washington Nationals gear from our friends over at Fanatics. Just head over to AOS21.com/theworldsonlypodcast and click on the banner at the top of our page to get great deals on World Championship Washington Nationals merchandise today.
Hey, wow, Fanatics actually has Expo stuff. This is a great site.
Now and again, in the history of World's Only Podcast, we delved into the prevalence of conspiracy theories in American politics. We talked about QAnon, the Chinese lab leak, Jeffrey Epstein's death. We did more than one segment on Russiagate. But regardless whether Sylvia and I agree with any given conspiracy theory, and each of us do subscribe to some, their hold on modern culture has fostered divisiveness, disinformation, destructiveness, and probably several other bad words that start with D. But then, in early December, the New York Times published a story about the Birds Aren't Real movement. Birds Aren't Real, which posits that birds don't exist and are really drone replicas installed by the U.S. government to spy on Americans, as the New York Times phrases it. If you're internet literate, you've probably already sensed that this is a gag, a parody of common internet conspiracies. The creator and the movement's hundreds of thousands of members are in on the joke. They know birds are real. But as a joke, the movement has served to poke fun at misinformation and disinformation and perhaps diminish its power. As the Times puts it, it's Gen Z's attempt to upend the rabbit hole with absurdism. The movement was started by a 23-year-old college dropout named Peter McIndoe, who says that birds aren't real is not a shallow satire of conspiracies from the outside. It is from the deep inside. A lot of people in our generation feel the lunacy in all this, and birds aren't real has been a way for people to process that. I admit I hadn't heard about birds aren't real until I'd read the story, but there was a time when I hadn't heard about QAnon either. Birds Aren't Real has been seriously reported on by local news stations. There are billboards in multiple states. It brings in a few a few hundred thousand dollars a month for McIndoe and his partner, Connor Gatos. It's still fringe, I'd say, but just barely. And it's worth noting, this is a youth movement. Gen Z has been marinating in internet culture since they could read. They were the first generation to not know life without the internet. And at least a few of them have found a way to use this for good. As one adherent to the movement put it, quote, "Most conspiracy theories are fueled by hate or distrust or one powerful leader. But this is about finding an outlet for our pain," she said. She added that the movement was more about media literacy. And Sylvie, when I read that, I saw a glimmer of hope. This self-evidently stupid thing is holding up a mirror to the rest of society and saying, it doesn't have to be this way. It's reminding us to laugh and not believe everything we see and read. Now, tell me why this thing is going to go wrong and be the doom of us all.
I want to say that I definitely agree with you. First, I do see the hope. I get where you're going with this. But I worry, you ask where it could go wrong. It can go wrong like anything else. It could be too much of a good thing. So I went back to some stories I read in 2016 that were written right around the time that Trump was first, when Trump was nominated, and then followed up about a year later after Trump was elected. And it's this idea of a smugness of American liberalism, to think that they're always right. Now, this isn't to say that a critique on birds aren't real. I, like you, I haven't heard about it until you actually told me about it. So I read it. I was interested by it, but I was thinking of, you know, can they take this too far? And by too far, I don't necessarily mean that people start believing that birds truly aren't real. I was about to say my dog caught one, but that wasn't a bird. That was a squirrel. Never mind.
Squirrels are real.
Yeah, I can attest to that. And the blood I cleaned off her mouth can attest to that too. But what I worry about is we get to a point where we hit the sort of John Stewart syndrome, or the late night syndrome, where you poke fun of something so much that they just coalesce around a counterculture, which is kind of what I felt happened with QAnon. This isn't necessarily to blame late night comedy for Trumpism, but it definitely helped incubate it. They didn't realize how far they were taking it. They needed to take their foot off the pedal at some point, and they didn't. And I think that's just what pushed people further and further into that camp, because they felt like they were being made fun of. They felt like they were outside of the culture. And that's kind of the only fear I have of this. Other than that, I agree with you. It is definitely an outlet for people's pain. It adds a nice level of satire to things like QAnon. By the way, I should point out that in one of our first segments on QAnon, you and I joked about it too. And that was well before the January 6th insurrection.
Because it seems so silly. Like, you made the comparison to QAnon. The comparison I was thinking about here was Flat Earth, which I feel like started as a joke initially. That was always my interpretation. And then it wasn't. Because I kind of wonder if anything is too unrealistic to be taken seriously, especially on the internet. Some of it comes back to sarcasm is hard to read. Like, it's hard to pick up on sarcasm when you're reading an internet comment, for example. And so identities get built around these movements. And right now, there's a leader, it seems like two leaders in charge who know what they're doing, who are in charge, or have now come out as being like, this is fake. But as a cultural meme, as this comes together, if people start identifying with this, with a lot of things that started kind of as a joke end up being like, no, these are my people, these are who I go with. And then outsiders, like you say, maybe it's a late night host, maybe it's a family member, someone else makes fun of you. Well, okay, or makes fun of that thing. Well, now are you making fun of me too? And you harden in that position. However stupid that position is, people put their identities into it.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you almost sound like you're agreeing with me.
I'm halfway there. Like, I have one foot over there, because I can see where this would be a good thing. Because I think for too long we did laugh at conspiracy.
It's a good thing, and for the most part, I'm in your camp. I'm just worried about it being taken too far and in the wrong direction.
It could be like this could still turn into like how Zuckerberg building Facebook into a business from his dorm room, because that seems to be like the state where McIndoe is with this thing. He could still go full cult leader with this thing, but so far he seems to have a pretty level head and a sense of humor about himself.
The sense I get is not that he's going to go full cult leader, it's that he could lose control of it. That's where if I had to put my money on something, that's probably where I would go.
Yeah, that seems plausible as well. One thought that kept coming to me was, oh yeah, you know, we shouldn't humor conspiracy theories, we should laugh at them. But then you bring up a very good point of, you keep laughing at them. So how do you address conspiracy theories when you give them power? Because I feel like if you debate them, you give them power. If you laugh at them, you make people feel, you know, feel like you're making fun of them rather than their idea. How do you contend? It's one thing to contend with your uncle at Thanksgiving dinner. It's another thing to, when there's a whole big thing to deal with it, how do you interact with that person?
I feel like when you debate them, you at least give them the air of taking them seriously. And that, I think, holds more sway than just out and out dismissing them. I kind of hark back to something President Obama said a couple of years ago, and I haven't been able to find it since, so I'm going to paraphrase here, and I apologize for not posting it, but I promise you he said something like this, which is ideas like this, and he meant, you know, it could either be on the left or the right, whatever, anything that seems like a conspiracy or a bad idea, it festers in the dark and dies in the light. And he didn't say that with any sense of poking fun of it. He didn't say it with any sense of dismissing it. He says, you bring it out where people can see it. On this podcast, I've always advocated for a position of openness in the concept of not ignoring things that are there, particularly with things like white supremacism. I think you once described me as keeping it where we can see it. And I think that's probably the most accurate way I can describe this type of phenomenon too, which is, it's a great outlet. It absolutely is. But we need to keep an eye for if and when it goes off the rails. And if that does start, I really hope the founders will take a hard look at themselves and say, okay, you know, maybe it's time to pull the plug.
But then someone else takes charge and maybe that leader doesn't have such a level head.
Yes, but if the founder is the one that pulls the plug, think again like Facebook. How right now, in the here and now, what would Facebook look like if Zuckerberg were to leave tomorrow?
I don't, like, there's this blank spot that could be filled with anything. And that's, I don't think it's necessarily more terrifying than Zuckerberg, but it's...
See, I think they break up. I think the leadership falls apart right now. I don't think there's a true succession line. Now, I've been wrong about that before. I thought the same thing about Apple when Steve Jobs died, and I was very wrong about that. But as it stands right now, I don't think there's a true succession line for Facebook in the same with someone to take over like Zuckerberg.
With regard to this, so you have to kind of know that it's there. I think a lot of these things rise without us knowing about it. I didn't know about Flat Earth. And like I remember running across a Flat Earth thing years ago on the internet, and it clearly seemed like a joke to me then. And the next time I heard about it, oh, it was a real actual movement where they really fully believe this. And you have one person actually built a rocket to try to go up and prove that you can't see a curvature of the Earth. I'll find a link to that. But he did end up killing himself in that rocket because it's a very stupid thing to do. If birds aren't real, we established, you know, it seems harmless or is harmless. But you and I didn't know about it until now, and it already has hundreds of thousands of members. For a real movement that was pushing something really destructive, already it will be too late to contain. You can debate it. I think you kind of need to at that point because it's already getting all the oxygen it needs. You're not at risk of giving it more, but you are at risk of maybe if you lose that debate, if you look bad in that debate, oh no, you've given it more power. I think that's a fear a lot of people have is if I engage with this thing and I come off badly, they look better. It can be really hard, and especially with some of these conspiracies that we talk about are so insane. I've said before on the show that conspiracy theory should be evaluated the way you would evaluate any other story. You look at the supporting evidence, you decide for yourself. Something seems so dumb that you kind of dismiss it and it's hard to see what you're doing. But some of these things are so far gone, you can't possibly be prepared for some of the dumb things that come at you and someone pushes you in a debate and you don't know how to respond to the very dumb thing.
If you don't know how to respond to the very dumb thing, then I got to give credit to the dumb person for putting together an argument, at least a dumb argument in a way that's hard to argue. And I've seen people do it before. I've met Trumpers who are excellent debaters, who are excellent theorists. I mean, love them or hate them, and I know most people hate them. Have you ever truly listened to Ben Shapiro talk?
I can't. He's a little squirrel. He's too fast. And I talk fast.
But guess what? He is excellent at arguing. All right. He is absolutely excellent at arguing. I'm not endorsing any of his points. I'm just saying he's excellent at getting his points across in a way a lot of people aren't.
And he's very good at baiting in a way that makes people frustrated. And
exactly.
That's part of what they do. Yeah.
Now, I will counter your argument about looking bad in the debate by saying if you ignore it, you're almost guaranteeing to give it power versus if you debate it, you at least have the chance if you do your own research or at the very least maybe outsource to somebody who knows how to, that you can nip it in the bud. I will take that chance.
Do we want to move to our closing thoughts here?
Yeah, I think we could, because we could definitely go on with this for a long, long time. So
there are a lot of levels to this one.
I mean, for me, I think the line is going to be if one of the founders ends up on late night Kimmel, Fallon, Colbert. Once that happens, I will be interested to see where this thing goes. Until then, I think it's going to be a nice niche. I think it's going to be a good community and outlet for people. But once it hits that level, that's where I'm going to start looking for the tipping point.
I've lamented before that we aren't ready for the internet, like we as a species. And I said just last month that our brains aren't built to handle it. And I still think that's true. But Gen Z knows how to handle it more maturely. I feel like their brains were formed by this thing. And rather than turning them into psychopaths, like a lot of people thought it would, they seem to know it's not real. They know the internet as a tool and they know how to use it. We'll see how this develops as they get older and they gain power and responsibility. But so far, they seem to be handling it okay. Yes, this could go bad. But right now, the kids seem to be all right.
You know, it made me think of, you described a story that your daughter is able to scroll on an iPad, right?
Yeah.
I think you said something along those lines. And maybe that's not such a bad thing. I was at, God, what was it? It was, I think, Jewish New Year. One of my wife's cousins has a five-year-old, and he's able to look through Google Maps, and he's looking at all the places he wants to go in the world. And I'm thinking to myself, that's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. You know, this is as we've talked about, what technology is supposed to be used for. So maybe you're right. Maybe the kids are all right. Maybe they do know how to use this thing responsibly. I am not exactly a fan of the idea of letting the quote unquote bad generations die off, but maybe that is what needs to happen.
I mean, it's not a letting, like all generations die off. So it's, you know, does it get replaced by something a little bit more mature and will.
Or a little worse. Now, I've been wrong on that argument before, so I don't take it as gospel.
Yeah, what, the one generation is better, is worse than another, or is it going to be better?
Or the generations can't pass down their bad ideas.
Yeah, bad ideas can sustain. It's the next generation is not necessarily better than the other one. I think they just had to have more promise.
All right, so ready to move on to our last segment ever?
Last? Oh, God, that hit me, man. Let's go.
This episode is sponsored by...
Hello, listeners. If you like the World's Only Podcast, then you'll love our merchandise, right, Ian?
I guarantee.
Head on over to tpublic.com/AOS21. That's AOIS21 for all the latest and greatest in World's Only merchandise. Also, check out the merchandise of other AOS21 podcasts as well.
I guarantee.
All right, so this is it, our last segment ever. And rather than cover a news story or cover some pop culture topic, we thought it would be nice to kind of reminisce about, you know, the formations of this podcast, what it's meant to us over the years, and kind of what we hope to look for going forward, I guess, with it. So I'll start. You said we started in the spring of 2016.
Yep.
When I said everything still seemed possible. Yeah, I will think back. I looked back at some of our earliest episodes and just kind of how we first put the recording together. So talking here right now in the most mature form of our podcast, we are recording on a program called Zencastr, which is a semi-grade professional recording software that splits our audio tracks, makes it easier to edit. When you and I started this thing, do you remember what we did?
I don't. I remember we adopted Zencastr later.
We started on Skype and using a third-party recorder that I had installed on my computer.
Oh, yeah. Wow, man, that's... Do you remember when we went to Zencastr? I feel pre-pandemic.
No, it was definitely pre-pandemic. That's for sure. I feel like we were only on doing that for maybe a year, maybe less. I think it might have actually been our producer Keith at one point who found it because he was using it for some of his other podcasts.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, if we had done this later, I think it would have been... You know, if we'd waited a couple of years, we would have been on Zoom, probably. I've never recorded anything on... I guess... No, I've never personally recorded anything on Zoom. I've been on recorded meetings.
We tried once on Zoom. It didn't really go over so well. This has always been our best software.
Yeah, this has been best. This is an unpaid advertisement, by the way, but Zencastr has worked pretty well for us. I think it's been pretty easy to use because you mostly end up doing the recording, but when Corey has stepped in, I've taken care of it. And it's, if I can use it, it's pretty good, I think. So that's how it started. I think it started with Keith Shovlin, our producer. I believe this was his idea initially, right?
I believe it was you and him trying to come up with an idea of something to promote your works, and it evolved into this.
That's
now.
Right. Yeah. And then you were working there for AS21, and that's how you got brought on. And so I think as long as we're giving thanks, we should thank Keith Shovlin for all the work he put into this. Like he I think he was doing the audio engineering early on too.
Yeah, he eventually partnered with a guy named Zach Cohen, who is now a reporter, I believe a congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. So, you know, he's gone a long way from our dinky little podcast. But definitely a lot of props go to Keith Shovlin for first helping us form this podcast, editing this podcast, and really helping us keep it going. So, yeah. You know, thank you, Keith. And I guess for me, the best thing it's been is that every month it's given me a chance, and I think you've mentioned this to me a couple of times, is to really study a couple of things in depth, stay on top of the news, make me feel more informed. And you've described this podcast before as a type of catharsis, given all the state of the world. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm going to miss the recordings that we do. And to a lesser extent, I'm going to miss editing the audio. I found like, oh, I enjoy editing audio. That's not something I ever would have thought I enjoy doing. I initially had the thought to step away because doing the prep and the analysis leading up to it got to be a little too much. It's really hard to delve in, read all the stories, because I think stories tend to be slanted in a way that make things appear more negative, but also we're living through a pretty rough time right now. I think you told me once on the show that your parents had said something about this being the weirdest time they've ever lived through.
Yeah. And they're, you know, in their 70s.
Yeah. And when you said that, it made me feel both better and worse. A bit better because, you know, some people with some perspective were feeling that too, but worse because, oh no, it's real. It's not just me. But the recordings were always fun. Like you said, yeah, it's a little bit of a catharsis too, like you said. Like there's something there, like talking with people about things, even terrible things, feels better than just reading about them. And yes, you and I always did this over the internet. We never did a show in the same room. But there was a human connection there. These weren't Facebook arguments. And that's something that's missing in the larger cultural dialogue that we're all yelling into screens at each other. And that's part of the darkness is that we're not. And yes, over the last year and a half, 2 years, that's been harder to do. I think that's why things appear much worse. But we stopped talking to and listening to each other even before that. And that's part of where the darkness came in.
That's something I'm definitely going to miss. It's not just like recording, but also just just talking to you every month, like getting together and talking with somebody, I would say intellectually.
I'm not dying. You can still do that.
But it's going to be different. It's not going to be the same analysis. It may not even be the same type of arguments. You have to admit that, you know, there's going to be a difference between you and I getting together and talking versus arguing or discussing, I think is a better term based on what you just said, topics that we've researched.
Yeah, there won't be the structure to it. That's true. I kind of wonder, just personally for me, maybe selfishly, I'm kind of hoping like, okay, I can read the news again without needing to necessarily have that analytical lens on the same way, that I can let it wash over me a little bit more, as opposed to the, okay, I'll spend a couple hours every night the week that we do it, just, okay, parsing the story. Well, what does this mean? What does that mean? What are the implications? Because that's frankly an exhausting way to live. I don't think it's how people were meant to interact with the world.
See, I would argue otherwise. I think that analytical aspect has helped me survive this period in our lives. It's helped me try to understand it better. It's helped me be able to describe in terms I can understand, you know, why things like Trump happened. You may not agree with the analysis, but it does make it more coherent in my mind, which does help.
Yeah, by analysis, I mean there's a difference between, okay, thinking about things versus, okay, I have to parse this for this other project that I'm doing. There's a little bit more, you know, I can take.
I don't know. Maybe, I mean, granted, you did this. I forget, your daughter was born 3 years ago, so I have to do a little bit of math here. So I would say about half the life of the podcast, you've been a father.
Yeah.
And I just had a kid, or my wife just had a kid. Sorry, dear. And I don't know how you do this with a kid. I really don't. Like, that's what finally tipped the scales for me. Like, maybe if you had come to me a month ago and said, I'm thinking of leaving, I might have looked at to try to continue this with somebody else, possibly. But with a child, I can't do it. I don't have the energy.
It's real hard. Yeah, it's honestly, I don't know how I did it either. I don't know how I do anything. You do. You find a way. You don't know how you do it, but it works. I was going to ask one more question. How have we changed in the course of doing this? And obviously, the big one is that we both have kids. And it's, I don't know if this has hit you yet, but we spent so much time examining the news. Have you gotten the sense of, oh, I brought a human being into this?
Yes and no. I mean, I don't think not bringing a human being in, when I met my now wife, I think I came to the realization that bringing a human being was just not an option. So I never tried to look at it that way. I mean, if I look at just the little bubble he's in right now, it's definitely full of love and support. And for that, I'm hopeful. I have no idea what type of sense the larger world is going to be, but I hope I can just prepare him to head into it, to take on whatever disaster comes his way the best he can.
Yeah, you can't give in to pessimism too much. You have to retain the sense of positivity just for the kid, if nothing else. You might sometimes feel like you did wrong by that kid, but I remind myself that as bad as things are right now, most of human history was actually much worse than this. Like I like not having tuberculosis. I like having streaming services.
That is true. You know, next week we're gonna do Jewish Christmas, Chinese food in a movie, but it's gonna be all at my parents' house, and he's gonna be able to join in, and I don't have to worry about taking him to a movie theater.
What are you gonna see?
We're not sure yet, but we're probably gonna pay pay per view for West Side Story.
Oh, that new one?
Yeah.
Okay. I knew nothing about it. Then all of a sudden, everyone was talking about it. And I had no idea they had remade it.
I saw it was coming, but I wasn't necessarily like I had my eye on it. But that seems to be the consensus among the people who are coming that, you know, maybe this is something we want to see. And, you know, as we've talked about before in a previous segment, what's nice about doing this from home is, you know, we can pause it. We can go use a bathroom. We can feed the kid. So I'll take that. I do want to give a shout out to, as you said, you and I have changed as people. And for me, some of the finer moments of this show came when we weren't necessarily doing a segment, but kind of bantering with each other, you know. Yes, there were the stupid jokes. The recent one about haggis really stands out to me. But also, like, when I told you I was getting married, when I told you I was going to be a father, and just listening to your reactions to that. I mean, this was our conduit, not just to the world, but to each other for over 4 years.
It's those little human moments. Like, in the light of the world, that's sometimes all you have, is those little, like, oh, a friend of mine's having a kid, or a friend of mine's getting married, or those little things. Like, I think I was trying to think of any life change I had. I guess we bought a house during the time that we've been doing this. Like,
no, that was your daughter too. I remember.
Yeah, because we already covered that, but I'm saying, like, I mentioned two things that have changed for you. Like, what are some other big life changes? And some, like, kid, oh, bought the house. It's, I think you've just taken on new jobs. It's kind of, you know, anyone who just listens to this only thinks of us for our opinions, but there's a life beyond that. Because another thing we forget when we're when people discourse online is, a person is not their opinions, or should, I think only the really darkest cases does the person become their opinions, but a person has a whole life beyond that as well.
No, that is true.
Yeah, this is a hobby. Like, we've never gotten paid for this.
We sure as heck never got enough listeners or endorsement deals to make it worthwhile, anybody's while besides ours.
In a way, I'm glad for that, because when I think about the worst opinions, they tend to be people who are professional opinion havers. I tend to think are the part of the problem.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This is why I tend to, in my postings, I admit I've been guilty of this more recently, but I try to avoid opinion sections of newspapers.
Yeah, and those are the hate click stuff. That drives a lot of...
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's...
I've gotten better at avoiding that. Somehow, I don't know if I did something right on the settings, but I feel like I've weeded a lot of that out of Facebook recently, but I also don't go looking for it, so...
Yeah, that's... You got to be real careful with that, because that's the stuff that obviously blows up. You can't totally ignore it, but you can know enough to not engage, and that's...
And maybe this podcast has helped with it. Maybe that is one of the reasons I'm able to better ignore the kind of hate-filled stuff out there and not engage with people as darkly as I did. Because I definitely feel there was a paradigm shift for me pre and post-Trump. I feel like pre-Trump, I was arguing with people all the time online. And post-Trump, I just kind of stopped. I felt maybe this was pointless.
So you had the opposite arc of a lot of people.
No, I did. Because in my mind, I felt like it was that type of arguing that maybe led to this type of thing. I stopped posting. I stopped with all the political news online, like every single day, and just focused more on sports, focused more on travel. And kept my news analysis to this podcast.
Because you can't do it all the time. You talk about analyzing being helpful, and I can see that, but you can't wait in it all the time. That's not healthy. You need to touch grass, as the kids say.
Is that a recent saying?
I only came across it a couple months ago, but remember we talked about OK Boomer? Like, that had been in the lexicon for a while, and I think a lot of people had only just found it. So these things, who knows where these things come from?
All right, I think it's time, unfortunately, to wrap this up. I'll start with the teary stuff. I will definitely miss doing this with you every month. As you said, it can be exhausting, but it was also one of the best things we did. I'm sitting here right now holding my son, and I'm kind of hoping, I think when we're done, I'm going to try to archive our episodes onto a hard drive and, you know, hoping to give it to my kid one day and hoping he'll listen to it and say, this is how... you and I, how your father interpreted the world in 2016 when you were born.
Daddy, why'd you spend so much time talking about Deflategate?
Because that was the better thing to talk about back then, if you really think about it.
I didn't ask about any regrets about the show. The one I have really is that I think we gave that a little bit too much time.
If that's your one regret, then we did a damn good job.
For my part, I'm reminded of that episode of Justice League, the cartoon from the 90s. I think the episode was called Star-Crossed. And Batman ejects Flash and Martian Manhunter from the watchtowers. It's crumbling out in space, sacrificing himself so he can save the rest of the league. And he says, gentlemen, it's been an honor. So I guess you would be Flash.
And you're the one crashing into the sea? Of course you get to be Batman. Who am I kidding?
Yeah, I'm Batman. Keith would be Martian Manhunter. And I think Corey would be Superman, who comes in and saves Batman there. By the way, thanks to Keith, to Corey Parker, who stepped in on several occasions. He's owed a thanks here.
Definitely. Not a big thanks, because I have to throw some shade at Corey. That's just because what him and I do. But definitely, thank you for stepping in when we've really needed a guest host and helping us keep this going to minimize breaks. All right. Are you ready to sign off?
Yeah. So, yeah. Thank you, listeners, again, you know, for your years of support, whether you were there from the beginning or this is your first episode, in which case this would be a weird first episode, I guess. I think this started just a fun thing for us. This was a thing just for us, but I hope that you got something out of it, too.
I hope that... Again, this will just serve as, you know, more of our own history, something we're able to keep. Listeners, I don't know how long I'm going to keep my handle on Twitter. The truth is I barely checked it throughout this podcast, so that's my confession now. But I'm still at Silby_says if you want to say anything.
Yeah, I'm going to be actually logging off for January, maybe longer, but I'm at Roberts Librarian.
And again, we thank you for staying with us all these years. Thank you for being our listeners, and... thank you for making this worthwhile.
Can we afford the theme song from MASH? That would be appropriate.
No. That's way beyond our budget.
Yep. Okay. All right. All right. Well, thank you, Sylvie, for the 5.5 years of trying to get me through this. You've been a good therapist.
Ditto. Definitely ditto. Take care, listeners.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the World's Only Podcast, a production of the AOS 21 Podcast Network. Hosted by Podomatic and available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play. Find us online at media.aos21.com. We'll We'll see you all next month as the world keeps turning.
Copyright 2021, AS21 Media. The AS21 Podcast Network. Your voice, your story, your passion, our mission.